With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome to the Mini Break, your daily podcast for the biggest storylines, results, and controversies from the tennis world. Today is Monday, March 29th. So many results for us to sift through from the past weekend of action. What we're going to do, as we always try to do here to start our week, reset things with all of the action in Miami. Of course, it was a fantastic weekend in the college tennis world. The ATP Challenger Tour never slows down. We're going to save those topics for our Great Shot podcast feed. David Gertler going to join me later in the week to recap all of the Challenger action. Of course, Matt Stachowiak, Chris Halioris already joined me on the podcast. That's going to be released Tuesday for all of you listeners, recapping a wild weekend of college tennis. But what I want to do to recap all of the action in Miami on part one, or this podcast is going to be two separate episodes, otherwise it'll be a three-hour episode. I'm going to recap the weekend matches in Miami. We're talking Saturday and Sunday. I believe that's back half round of 64, front half round of 32 for the men, and then I think both round of 32s for the women. And then on part two of the podcast, I'll recap Monday's matches. So round of 16 for the women, round of 32 for the men. Now, of course, you may have already seen those results and, you know, the impact of them on how I feel about the previous day's results. To me, it makes no difference. I can be really excited about someone's performance in the round of 32, round of 64, whatever it may be. They can then lose their next match. I can still be excited about the previous match. And of course, there's a lot to be excited about. I don't want to skip any of that because, again, we're just so excited to have tennis week in, week out, day in, day out amidst a pandemic. We want to celebrate and take note of all of the matches that are happening. But again, on today's podcast, just going to be me steering the ship part one. I'm going to recap all of Saturday and Sunday's Miami results. Part two, I'll recap everything on Monday so that we're fresh to go Tuesday night, recapping Tuesday's matches, and so on and so forth. Of course, the reason I'm able to do this day in, day out here on the Mini Break podcast, week in, week out, is because of all of the support we get from all of you fantastic listeners, the support we get from our Patreon subscribers, and sincerely, thank you to those Patreon subscribers. It may be $1, $2, $5 a month. It adds up, and it supports all of the things we try to do here at Cracked Rackets. And then, of course, I can do this day in, day out here on the Mini Break podcast because of the support we get from our friends at Midwest Sports. It's outdoor season, folks. Update your gear so you can get your best performance for your return to the court. Go to MidwestSports.com where you can find all of the best gear at all of the best prices. You use best prices. Hey, great shot. You use our promo code CR15. You'll get 15% off your order. Free 2-day shipping on all orders exceeding $75. And best of all, a free can of Wilson Extra Duty Tennis Balls. MidwestSports.com. The promo code is CR15. With that in mind, whew, do we have some tennis to talk about? Let's start on the women's side. And for me, there are two big storylines, and I talked about them on the deciding point. So if you listen to our Great Shot podcast feed, you may have already heard an abbreviated version of both of these storylines. You know, one of them is the performance of the top seeds, who have been exceptional in Miami, and I promise folks we'll get there. But storyline number one, the most feel-good story, and perhaps the most impactful story moving forward, is the return of Anna Konya to an elite level in a WTA 1000 level event. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the name Anna Konya, the 23-year-old Croatian is a former world junior number one who won the 2013 Junior Australian Open singles title. She followed that up playing a classic 2013 U.S. Open girls singles final. I believe that match against Tornado Alicia Black, it was a 7-6 in the third battle back at the 2013 2013 U.S. Open. Again, for me, that's senior year of high school. So that's right in the prime when I'm following those things closest, if you're asking why I remember that. But let's talk about some of the other things Konya has accomplished in her young career. A, she made her WTA debut, hey, great shot, in 2014. At age 16, she made her debut in the top 100. In 2015, she won her first WTA title in Nottingham, becoming the youngest player to win a main tour event since 2006. She also reached a career high ranking of number 20 in the WTA rankings in July of 2017. That came on the back of second-round performances at the Australian Open and French Open, a fourth round at the 2017 Wimbledon, and a quarterfinal at the 2016 U.S. Open. You look at what she's accomplished, you know, more granularly throughout her career. Of course, she's had a couple of top 10 wins. Of course, I mentioned the Junior Slam title she's had in her career. The top 10 win, she beat Radwanska at the U.S. Open in the fourth round. She beat Konta and Sibulkova in 2017. She was on her way to establishing herself as one of the top young players in the women's game. And then, unfortunately, injuries and off-court, you know, setbacks have held her back these past few seasons. You look overall in 2018, she was barely able to play. In total, she played 6 matches. She goes 2-4 in those matches. 2019, she's only able to play 5 matches. Then 2020, she's not able to play at all until after the tour restarts in August. She goes 12-5 in primarily ITF 25K level events, makes a couple of semifinals, wins a 25K title in Zagreb to end the season. And then here to start the year, 9-6 overall. But most importantly, you know, she plays qualifying at the Australian Open, loses a 3-set match to Irani, qualifies in Dubai before losing to Anisimova, loses second round of qualifying in St. Petersburg, but makes the most of her wild card here on the weekend. And, you know, this past weekend, she knocked off Iga Swiatek. That was the big result on Saturday. 6-4, 2-6, 6-2. It comes on the back of her beating Madison Keys and Katerina Siniakova in straight sets. And I mean, you watch Konya play for, you know, 10 minutes and you're like, oh yeah, that, and you find out she's 23. You're like, I bet she was really good in the juniors because the ball just explodes off of her racket. And let's start with the backhand, because her ability to catch that backhand early, go both cross court and down the line with tremendous power, her ability to buy time on that wing, elevate shots over the net, her ability to catch that ball early and go short angle. And it just makes sense why, you know, when you watch her, you're like, oh yeah, with that contact point, with the way she swung, that ball should go exactly there. It just looks so easy for her on that wing. And then the forehand, it's an extreme grip, but she's able to produce heavy topspin, change direction, create angle, take the ball early. The ground strokes are really nice. And again, you look for her performance here in her matches against Swiatek. She makes 63.64% of her first serves, wins 71% of those points, 50% of her second serve points, saves 4 of the 7 break points she faced, but, you know, created 14 break chances for herself. Only converted 4 of them, but they were the 4 she needed. She won over, she won 53.5% of her second serve return points, 37% of her first return points, but about 44% for the match. With the way she was holding serve, that was good enough. And look, you watch her play, it's clear Anaconia's movement is not where it needs to be. And movement was never the strongest part of her game, but, you know, she really hasn't played this level of matches in 2-3 seasons. So the fact that her footwork, you know, if you can get her stretched into the outer thirds, she'll either, you know, just say, good shot, you win this rally. She's very good at conserving her energy. Or, you know, again, she'll be stretched, she'll hit a slice, and then you can go to the open court, you can go behind her, things start to open up if you can get her on her back foot. But you can say that about a lot of people. And I think the most promising part for Anaconia is the fact that, you know, she hasn't played a competitive match in 3 years. Give her 2 months of WTA action. I promise you, she will get back into the sort of match shape she was 2-3 seasons ago. That's the last piece that comes back when you're working from a long injury like this. And the fact that the ground strokes look at as good as they do, the fact that, you know, again, in each of the matches she played this week, she won about 70% of her first serve points. She was over 50% on second serve points in two of her three victories. You know, I've already seen her money. She loses to Sevastova. Spoiler alert. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but or on part two of this podcast. But you know, you watch Konya, and you can watch a lot of players in the top 100. The ball doesn't explode off of their rackets the way it does from her. She just has that talent. She's in that top, you know, 0.1, 0.5% of pro players who the ball just comes off the racket differently than everyone else. And again, patience will be the key. Even with her result here this week, Konya only at number 241 in the live rankings. So she, you know, she's going to get some wild cards probably, but she'll still have to play ITF events, 100Ks, qualifying. She'll get a lot of matches under her belt if her body's able to hold up. But if her body's able to hold up, she'll be in the top 100 by the end of the 20. I'm not with the rankings protections, maybe not this year, but I'd say the 2022 season. She's too talented. The ball, she just strikes the ball too well. If you don't have weapons, she's going to hurt you. If you leave a ball in the center of the court, she's going to punish you. And even when you get her stretched, she can do some special things. Anna Konya was fantastic this week. Her win over Swiatek, again, 6-4, 2-6, 6-2, was one of the matches of the weekend. And again, you know, Swiatek, I thought, did a really good job because she went down an early break in that second set. She could have just gone away. She didn't. She bounces back, takes the set 6-2. But, you know, she just got a little tentative. She, you know, Konya threw a lot of pace at her, particularly at that forehand wing, and Swiatek would leave a ball short in the center of the court. And, you know, in the match, her second serve sat up a little bit, and these courts in Miami are playing so slow, and that does help Anna Konya for sure. But, you know, the forehand, it was a little concerning because you do, and it really wasn't concerning. I thought actually Swiatek competed really well, even though her game, she didn't have her A game on the day. But again, she did fight off 10 of the 14 break chances she faced. She kept this match super competitive. Konya just had the bigger weapons. I suppose that's the scary thing, is if Konya has bigger weapons than Swiatek, she must be striking the ball well, and she is. You know, again, for Swiatek, the forehand broke down a little bit in this match when pressured by pace, but I thought she moved really well. She did a really solid job of withstanding the first strike of Konya. The problem is Konya's second strike was just on this day, and I think she fed her backhand. It was just anytime Swiatek hit to that backhand wing, it felt like Konya took control of the rally. It was a really good performance from Anna Konya, but again, no concern from Iga Swiatek. It's maybe her first round of third, like second round of 32 at a Masters event. This was not a bad loss by any stretch of the imagination. And by the way, with this result, Swiatek, who's still putting points on the board for herself, she's going to move up, I believe, in the rankings. Or excuse me, stay put at number 16. But she did gain points this week by making the round of 32 in Miami, which of course is a little bit funny. And the fact that she's a Grand Slam champion and still not ranked inside the top 10. But that was your big result from Konya. That's storyline number one. Storyline number two, as I mentioned, is the story of the top seeds continuing to show their form. Let's start with one of the less heralded seeds, a top seed who some people often, I don't want to say some people, I hate attacking arbitrary straw man. It's fair to say Alina Svitolina's upside is not as high as someone like a Naomi Osaka, like a Bianca Andreescu, like an Aryna Sabalenka even, who, when they're playing their best tennis, simply put, will just hit their opponents off the court. Of course, you want to put Kvitova in that list, Muguruza, obviously a higher ceiling as well. But Alina Svitolina is damn good. And outside of Simona Halep, she's been the most consistent player in the women's game over the past 7.5 seasons. Don't believe me? Let's look at her record since 2014. 38-24, 41-24, 41-22, 53-16, 44-16, 40-21, 21-19. She's now 13-5 to start the season here as she makes the quarterfinals of this event. But this past weekend, a really impressive victory, 7-6, 6-4 over Ekaterina Alexandrova. And it's a small thing because we all know Svitolina's going to track down a ton of balls. She's going to make a bunch of extra shots. She's going to move the ball well around the court. She's going to absorb your pace, redirect it. But if you have the big weapons, you can overwhelm her. But Svitolina, I think it's an eye test numbers thing sort of matching up. Her first serve percentage on the season, a little bit lower than it normally is. She's currently, I believe, at 58.1% for the season. That's under her career average of 61.4. However, she's winning 68% of her first serve points. That's greater than her first serve percentage of 66 for her career. She's also at 48 on the second serve. That's better than her career number of 46. I think that's an eye test thing. You can see she's trying to be a little bit more aggressive on serve, trying to create some plus one opportunities, a few more free points in the match, even if it leads to, you know, a slight dip in the first serve percentage. She trusts the rest of her game, and it's just, can she make things easy enough for herself over the course of a long match with a Sabalenka and Osaka, who eventually are going to find their rhythm, right, and just hit you off the court for three straight games? Can Svitolina do that to her opponent? Is the question that will determine, respectfully, whether she wins a Grand Slam in her career or not, because she's so excellent at everything else. Again, a top 10 mover in the women's game. I think forehand, backhand, wing, neither is a glaring error. She's able to do all the things she wants with the shots. Go line, go cross, short angle, elevate to create time. She's got pretty good hands. Not great, but good enough hands at the net, and is able to recognize when the opportunity presents itself for her to move forward. Again, it's not the sexiest pick to say Svitolina is going to make the semifinal of the event, but that's what usually happens whenever she's playing something like this, at least the quarterfinals. And again, she just kind of worked Alexandrova in this match, threw a bunch of different looks at her, never went in the same direction more than twice in a row, because if you go in the same direction twice in a row, Alexandrova's got enough pop from the ground to hit through you, and she benefits from these slow court conditions as well, gives her that extra half second to set her feet. But Svitolina just threw a million different looks at her, and again, it was a really impressive victory for Svitolina to advance to the round of 16, and ultimately we'll talk about her round of 16 match again in part two of this podcast. Those were the two breakdowns I wanted to get to from Saturday's results in terms of, again, the other matches. Kvitova, straight set wins over Konta. It felt like this might be one of those weeks for her. She looked so outstanding, has continued to be great here early in 2021. Sabalenka, really nice victory over an informed Veronika Kudermetova. Again, Kudermetova is not going to be a top 10 player. She just doesn't quite have enough of everything to get to that upper echelon. But she's going to beat a lot of top 20, top 10 players throughout her career, because when it looks good, it looks really good for Kudermetova. She's a great athlete. She plays low, flat tennis, and I think these courts were perfect for her. Sabalenka just overwhelmed her with her power. It was one of those days for Sabalenka, but Kudermetova made her sweat. And she was up 4-3 in that first set tiebreaker, two Sabalenka serves. Kudermetova missed two returns that she would love to have back, because they were very makeable returns. But then Sabalenka hit a return winner and I think a backhand down the line winner, and that was the set. And that's what Aryna Sabalenka will do to you. Great performance for her. Great performance for Vika Azarenka, who I think moves to 9-1 in her career head-to-head with Angelique Kerber. Kerber threw everything at Azarenka in that first set and led at multiple different times, but just didn't have enough firepower to hit through Azarenka again, particularly on these slow courts. Azarenka, the run last year was real, folks. She's back. She looks great. 5-2 win over Kerber. You also had victories on the day from Ashley Barty, who she, you know, people question her deservance of the number one ranking. I'm not going to question the merits of their questioning of her having the number one ranking, because, yeah, she hasn't played as much tennis as a lot of other players these past 15 months. But she's absolutely a top five player in the women's game. Her movement, her ability to move the ball around the court, her ability to absorb what you do and take away the thing you want to do the most, special, folks. And she just worked Ostapenko to the corners in this match. It was a fun straight set victory for her. Fortunately, Halep pulled out with injury against Sevastova. Hopefully, we get her healthy for the French Open run. And then Markéta Vondroušová, three-set win over Belinda Bencic, 4-6, 6-4, 6-4. That match was fantastic. I'm not going to do a full breakdown because if I do, this podcast will go 6 hours. But Vondrousova, the lefty, slow courts, move the ball around the court, threw a million different looks at Bencic. Bencic is starting to play her best tennis again, folks, and that firepower can hit through anyone. But Vondrousova made her work. And again, it was a really, really fun, high-level three-set match. That was your Saturday action. Let's go to Sunday now on the women's side. Again, just a couple, nothing too crazy for you in terms of the breakdown. No Konya Svitolina-esque breakdowns. But the Sunday tennis across the board was fantastic. You had 8 matches, 7 really, given that Osaka got a withdrawal from Stojanovic. 6 of the 7 matches go 3 sets on the day. And I mean, let's start with the nightcap. Bianca Andreescu, 7-6, 6-7, 6-4 over Amanda Nisimova. I don't know how else to say it other than this. If healthy, Andreescu's back. She is that talented. She is that good. That run to the U.S. Open title was no fluke, folks. And the level in this match was incredibly high. And look, Anisimova's dealt with a ton of different injuries, a ton of, you know, off-court things. And we don't have to relitigate those right now. But she's got so much talent, does the young American. And I mean, what, she's 5'11", 6 foot. Her serve, her ground strokes, the power she possesses. When she connects cleanly with the ball, it's either going to be a winner or it's going to set up a winner on the next stroke. And, you know, I'm so sad I didn't think of this comparison earlier. It reminds me of a modern Karolina Pliskova. Anisimova, a little bit more fluid, but if you leave a center in the a ball in the center against her, against Pliskova, the point is over, and they use their length to, you know, beat you to the spot, take the ball early. Neither of them is going to be the most fluid movers around the court, but because of their length, they're able to cut, track down that extra ball and put it on your body before you're ready to hit it. And, you know, I think Anisimova's serve is really dynamic as well. And in this match, she made 70% of her first serves, won, you know, over 63.5% of her first serve points, 56.8% of her second serve points, fought off 14 of the 17 break points she faced. Now, why I say Andreescu's legit. Andreescu got broken twice, but those were the only two break points she faced. She was 0 of 2 in terms of saving them, but she was 46 of 59, 78% on first serve points, 20 of 40 on second serve points. Whenever she was able to play plus one tennis or just get that return deep on the body of Anisimova, she essentially won the point. Whenever she was able to get her stretched and she used her variety, her drop shots, her short angles, taking the ball early, moving forward, hitting swinging volleys, she can do a little bit of everything, and she moves really well. And again, she was able to withstand the overwhelming power of Anisimova. She didn't get too flustered when Anisimova would hit that kind of stretched out, looped over Medvedev-ish stretch forehand down the line winner, which Anisimova can do because, again, she's got that sort of firepower. But Andreescu throws everything at you, and she's got that sort of firepower as well. The jack of all trades. She's so delightful to watch, so happy she's healthy. She continues to find her form, and this is her best win yet as she knocks off Anisimova in 3 sets. And now she's got Garbine Muguruza, who knocks off in 3 sets Kalinskaya. You know, we talk enough about Muguruza, but that was a great result. Kalinskaya is the real deal, folks. She's got that sort of firepower as well. That's what's so exciting about so many of these young players. They all just hit the ball differently. Like, it's just incredible. You can't leave balls in the center. Clara Tosin, Shenyu Wang, Kalinskaya. Obviously, I just went on and on about Amanda Anisimova. I mean, I don't know if it's technology. I don't know if it's fitness. It's probably a combination of everything. The next generation of women's tennis is going to be so, so outstanding, and there's so many talented young players. Kalinskaya, one of them, but Muguruza, just too good. Credit to Ons Jabeur. Gets the first top 10 of her win of her career, 3 sets over her nemesis on the court, Sonia Kenin. You know, this match featured so much variety, so much fun point construction, far too many drop shots for any human's liking, but it was a really physical match. And again, for Kenin, she usually wins this one. She didn't today, but she's still finding her way back post-surgery, post many different things, so I thought it was a good competitive result for her. Jabeur's just really confident right now, playing some great tennis. That's a great win for her. A well-earned first top 10 win of her career. In terms of the highest quality match I saw on the day, Elisa Mertens, Annette Contave, I mean, that's the Alex Gruskin special. I talk about those players almost every week on the Mini Break. They're not the Grand Slam contenders, but they're the best of the rest. They're the ones who you can just pencil into your round of 16s at each and every round at Grand Slam, because unless you are significantly better than them, you're not going to beat them. They can just do a little bit of everything. They move well. They put balls away. Variety, forehands, backhands, serve. Returns. That's the Mertens Contave story. And this match was physical. I mean, hour 47 for a 6-2, 0-6, 6-2. You think, oh, those are all lopsided matches. This is probably sets. This is probably a quick match. But no, I mean, 10, 15, 20 ball rallies. You know, Contave kind of figured out, okay, I want to go to the Mertens forehand side because that's the more. I suppose, or that's the side with more variance that fluctuates more than her backhand wing. But Mertens just threw the kitchen sink at Contave, and you know, they both again move really, really well. They both take advantage when the opportunity presents itself to move forward, attack a short ball, change direction. This was just fun, physical tennis. And you know, Mertens is the WTA wins leader last year for a reason. She's a really tough out right now. Contave just didn't have quite enough juice. And it really felt like after Contave won the first game of the third set that she was going to win, in my opinion, the set. But then Mertens just found a level, raced out to a 5-1 lead. Contave kept fighting back, but you know, it just felt like every game point broke Mertens' way in that third set, and that's a credit. When you're confident, things roll your way. They certainly are for Elisa Mertens right now. She's into the round of 16. Your other three results, Sara Cerebes Tormo, who, by the way, now 25-11 in her last, 27-11 in her last 52 weeks. She's knocked off Bernarda Pera in three sets, Jennifer Brady in three sets, and now Elena Rybakina in three sets as she earns a 6-1, 3-6, 6-2 victory. She just plays high percentage tennis. You know, she makes 70% of her first serves now. Those serves are so attackable. And, you know, she only wins 57.3% of her first serve points, 45.3% of her second serve points. The good news for her, her first and second serves are fairly similar. The good news is she's won 49.2% of her return points over the last 52 weeks. She puts about every return in play. Her backhand slice just gives people trouble. And then she moves so well around the court. Obviously, she's coming off of a win in Guadalajara, a semifinal in Monterrey. She's confident as can be. And now with these results, Sara Cerebes Tormo, who, by the way, only 24 years old, up to a new career high of number 48 in the rankings. And what's so scary is, you know, with her game style, she's going to be really, really tough out on the clay. So for her to rack up this many points at the WTA level this early in the season, be on the lookout for her to crack the top 40. Be on the lookout for her to potentially be seeded come the Women's French Open. She's that well positioned. She's playing that well. Such high percentage tennis. Again, she tracks everything down. That backhand slice is going to give you difficulties. It was a fantastic victory for her. Three sets over. Again, it was just the perfect contrast. She broke the strike zone of her opponent, 6-1, 3-6, 6-2, Elena Rybakina, who, again, I continue to say, another three-set loss for her. She's come so close so often this season. Don't give up hope on Rybakina, but certainly start thinking confidently, positive thoughts about Sara Cerebes Tormo. She has been fantastic here in 2021. And just quickly, by the way, because I'm talking about how fantastic these players have been, by ELO ranking, the tennis abstract, which again measures who you're beating, not where you're or when you're beating them, Sara Cerebes Tormo right now number 47 on their ELO rankings by yearly ELO ratings, which is again ELO ratings, who you're playing or who you're beating just in this 2021 season. She's the number 20 player by Tennis Abstract yearly ELO rating. She's 11-3 on the year. And honestly, number 20 feels about right. She has been, although she's ahead of people like Kvitova, so that's not right. Jabeur, that's probably not right. But, you know, again, she's certainly been a top 50 player. You could argue top 30 these past 52 weeks. She's just now certainly starting to have the results to prove that ranking. God, I could get lost in these yearly ELO ratings. Kasatkina's 3 right now. That's probably a stretch. Jessica Pegula's 4 right now. Is that a stretch? Given she's beaten Karolina Pliskova now three times, she does it again, 6-4 in the third to advance to the round of 16. I don't know. Number four, yeah, that's a stretch. But she's been a top 20 player certainly here to start the year. A fantastic win for her over Pliskova. And then Maria Sakkari continues to rock and roll. She's regained her rhythm. 0-1 win for her over Samsonova. That's your round of 16 on the women's side. On the men's side, again, fantastic set of results. And I think the title of today's podcast is going to be Slow Courts Equals Fantastic Tennis. That has truly manifested itself on the men's side. I mean, you start to look at some of the players who have had success here this week, guys like Daniel Gallant, who was so outstanding on the clay courts to end last season, and I think made a semifinal at one of the South American clay court 250s, a guy like Sebastian Korda, Francis Tiafoe. Korda was a fourth-round French Open. Tiafoe, highest win percentage by surface for him is clay. A guy like Diego Schwartzman, or even, you know, the character of players, the Marin Ciliches of the world, the Taylor Fritzes of the world, too, Emil Roussevoris, who, you know, aren't bad movers, but certainly on a quicker court, their lack of elite movement gets exposed. Well, you give them an extra half second, extra second, give them a high bounce like these courts in Miami are giving them, they're going to go on runs, because when they have clean contact with the ball, they hit the ball as hard, if not harder, than anyone. And that sort of dictated the results we've seen across the board here this weekend in Miami. Let's start with Daniel Gallant, who with his victory over Alex de Minaur 4-6, 6-3, 6-4, was 26-19 in his last 52 weeks, but reaches the round of 32 at a Masters, first Masters victory of his career. You look now in the live rankings with these results. Gallant up to a new career high of number 110. He is now about, 784, 739, about 46 points away from cracking the top 100. And he has been that good. I mean, you look for him over the last 52 weeks. Qualified, made the third round of the French Open. He wins the challenger in Lima on the clay. Makes a semifinal the week after in Campinas. Made a semifinal at the Cary Challenger. To start this season, he wins a match in Delray Beach and, you know, makes that semifinal in Santiago. He's been right on the border of being a top 100 player. And, you know, find someone who looks at you, who loves you the way Daniel Gallant loves to hit forehands, and on these slow courts, boy, did he find forehands against Alex de Minaur. And you know, it's very Kyle Edmundy in the way he dominates off of that wing. If you give him a forehand, he's in control of the point, and he's going to go inside out, inside out, inside out to open in up the inside in forehand. And you know, his backhand's not a weapon, but it's more than just a placeholder. Like, he is confident with his backhand in rallies. He can move that ball around. He hits a really, really heavy kick serve. And you look for him against de Minaur. He won 72% of his first serve points, fought off 10 of the 13 break points he faced. I mean, he just had the biggest weapon on the court. And, you know, de Minaur has taken some tough losses over the past few weeks. You look for him now over his last 52. He's, you know, 19-13, but the finals he made, or the title he won in Antalya to start the season, the final he made in Antwerp, and then the quarterfinals in the U.S. Open, doing a lot of the heavy lifting. You know, he's now lost his last three matches, all in three sets. It was, you know, three sets to Nishikori, three sets to Chardy, three sets to Daniel Gallant. He lost three sets to Bautista Agut, ATP Cup. He lost three sets to Yannick Sinner and Sofia, three sets to Daniil Medvedev in Paris. His fitness keeps him in every match he plays, and his speed, the amount of pressure he puts on you, that sneaky athleticism, that sneaky pop on the forehand, he's a good bet to win a set in each and every match he plays. The problem is, you know, the first serve is good, it's not great, and the second serve sits up a little bit. And, you know, again, he's going to be a top 20, top 25 guy throughout the course of his career as long as he's healthy. What gets him into Grand Slam contending range is, can he develop that weapon? Can he make that first serve a legitimate, sets up a plus one ball for him every time? Can he get more free points? Because he does make things so difficult for himself, given his athleticism. I mean, that's what he wants. But of course, that is just a tough style to play, 3 out of 5 sets for 2 weeks. And Gallant had bigger weapons than him in this match. And certainly that's concerning, given Gallant not a top 100 player. But Daniel Gallant will be a top 100 player shortly. And he's only, 23, 24-year-old Colombian. But, you know, if you're Demon Hour, you're disappointed. You were so close in this match. But, you know, if you're Daniel Gallant, you're elated because you have played that well of late and the results are finally starting to come together. These conditions were perfect for him and he made the most of them, getting the three-set victory. Speaking of making the most of the conditions of the matches available to you, Sebastian Korda moves to 28-8, I believe, in his last 52 weeks as he knocks off Fabio Fognini, earning the highest ranked win of his career with a 1-6, 6-4, 6-2 victory over the number 10 seed. I mean, look, Korda's numbers the last 52 weeks, 29-8 overall. French Open fourth round, first two challenger titles of his career, first ATP final of his career in Delray Beach. Now he makes the first round of 32, and spoiler alert, first round of 16 at a Masters event of his career. You look at the live rankings now, despite all the protection, Sebastian Korda up to a new career high of number 76. You look in the ELO ratings, by the way, by ELO rating, Daniel Gallant right now, number 132 by yearly ELO rating. Let's see what Daniel Gallant is right now. By yearly ELO rating, he's 107. However, Sebastian Korda, number 28 by yearly ELO rating, number 36 overall by ELO rating. I had this debate tonight with someone. I think he's a top 50 player, and I think it's pretty hands down. Like, I don't think if you say to anyone, do you think Sebastian Korda is a top 50 player right now? You look at his results, and I think you have to say yes. And I think you can go even higher than that. He really has been borderline a top 32 player in the world. Like, if I asked you, who are you more confident in right now moving forward, Sebastian Korda or Alex de Minaur, because they're fairly similar in age? Before this year, no, or before August, absolutely no one says Korda. After his French Open run, there may be a few people who say Korda. Now? Is it 50-50? I mean, if you're listening to this podcast and you feel strongly, please tweet at me, @GreatShotPod. Korda versus de Minaur. Who do you feel more strongly about? Certainly, Korda's got the bigger weapons. He's got the definition of your modern male tennis player physical profile, and he's got the results of late as well. Yeah, it's a hot take, no denying that. I'm not saying I feel that way. I'm saying I don't feel any better about about Alex de Minaur than I do Sebastian Korda. I feel equally exceptional about both. And Sebastian Korda just, 76% of his first serves, wins 69% of those points, fights off 8 of 12 break points, gets the 4 of 8 on his break point chances. He's just efficient. He's disciplined. It looks so easy. He can do a little bit of everything. Sebastian Korda, fantastic result over Fabio Fognini. In terms of the rest of your Saturday results, again, these were round of 64 matches, so going to rapid fire through them. Straight set wins from Tsitsipas, Andre Rublev, and Diego Schwartzman, all top five seeds. Shapovalov played a testy, but ultimately very fun 6-7, 6-4, 6-4 match against Ilya Ivashka to advance. I thought it was great the way Shapovalov adjusted, the way he slowed down, but I still think physically, he clearly looks like he's taken a step forward this year. I think Milos Raonic looks really good this week. 2-1 win over Jordan Thompson. These high bouncing conditions, so great for the serve and volleyers. And, you know, that's why you saw him win. We saw Isner have success as well. You know, you look across the board. Cilic, another guy, beats Christian Garin 7-6 in the third. Cilic having his best week since probably the 2019 season. Your other winners, Karatsev over Kukushkin, Umber over Sosa, Musetti, allowing Benoit Paire to go on an early vacation. Sonego, Mannarino, Hurkacz, Nishikori, Fuksovic in a very fun three-set match over Tanasi Kokkinakis. Your other winners on Saturday. Let's move now to Sunday's matches. And again, I know it's a bit monotonous here. Just have a lot of tennis to catch you all up on. I apologize if you're sick of my voice. Although I suppose at this point, it is an everyday podcast and I think I'm on it every day. So probably used to my voice. So with that in mind, let's talk about the round of 32 matches. A lot of these were fun. We had 8 of them, I believe. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of... Oh, no, no, that can't be right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 matches. 6 of the 8 go 3 sets, and if you include the 7-6, 7-6 affair between Isner and FAA, again, 7 of the 8 decided on the margins. Your one straight set win, Sasha Bublik, who continues to ride his momentum. You look at the yearly ELO ratings and ELO ratings. Bublik right now by ELO rating, number 23 by yearly ELO rating. You look for Bublik number 43 by general ELO rating. You look for him right now in the live rankings, Sasha Bublik number 45. That feels about right, as it's really difficult to beat the big serving 23-year-old from Kazakhstan. You look at the other results. You know, Medvedev was cramping against Alexei Popperin at the end. That may be the story you want. The real story, Medvedev 45 of 49 on first serve points. Alexei Popperin, his first serve, his forehand, they're elite. And he won, you know, 73% of his first serve points, goes 54 of 74. He saved, I believe, 7 of the 9 break point that he faced and was only broken twice in the match against maybe the third best returner on tour or second best returner right now in Daniil Medvedev. But, you know, if you can get the ball to his backhand wing, if you can prevent him from setting his feet and turning into a forehand, you're going to be able to have success against him. And, of course, no one does better at taking away the thing you want to do the most than Daniil Medvedev, who had just enough, who placed his serves just well enough to escape in a three-set, him cramping at the end victory. And, again, Alexei Popperin, that forehand, that serve, they're going to win him a lot of matches in his career. And he's coming off of the first ATP title of his career. He's been really great of late. But, you know, again, the inside-out forehand return he ripped to clinch the set on set, to clinch the second set on set point, that's sort of him in the nutshell. When he does that, when that shot's landing, he can beat anyone. But he can also very much, that on that list of anyone, includes himself. And just, you know, again, Medvedev makes things so tough for him. Popperin fought, but Medvedev just a little bit too much in the end. The best match of the day on Sunday on the men's side belonged to Jannik Sinner, who knocked off Karen Khachanov 4-6, 7-6, 6-4 in an incredibly physical affair. You know, Sinner just hits the ball at a different speed, and with just more velocity, more pace, more action than 99% of players. And look, he's 27-11 now in his last 52 weeks. He reaches the round of 16 at a major for the first time in his career. And, you know, his first serve now, he's winning 70% of his first serve points, 53% of his second serve points. He's holding 81% of the time. He's breaking serve about 27% of the time, which isn't quite Djokovic, Nadal, prime of their career level good, but that's better than prime Roger Federer. And he's, you know, holding serve at over 80%, which is a really, really good mark. And, you know, I just think physically he becomes a better and better mover, it feels like, with every match. That cross-court little flick slice shot he hit off of a Khachanov drop shot to create a breakpoint chance for himself at 4-all in the third set, you know, that just epitomizes his improving athleticism. And again, his ability to change direction. Khachanov tried to play to his backhand wing, but Sinner was having none of that. He was going down the line with his backhand, cross-court with his backhand, never hitting the ball in the same direction more than 2 times in a row. And just, you know, you can't let him play plus one forehand tennis because his weapons are too big. You can't let him play, you know, big on the return. You have to make a high percentage of first serves because you just can't give him control of the point. But, you know, as he gets into the outer thirds of the court, he gets better and better with each passing match as well. He's just a stud. I'm all in on Jannik Sinner. He does have Grand Slam champion type upside. And I'm not saying I didn't believe that before, but I thoroughly believe it now. Not just one slam, but I may feel better about him. I mean, certainly then, he's probably above the, I really like Korda of late, but he's definitely above the Demon Hour tier, the Chorich tier, the Khachanov tier. He's advanced at a minimum into the Shapovalov FAA tier. He may even be amongst the group now. It might be the big four of CT, you know, I still really think FAA is going to win a Grand Slam one day, so I keep him in that group, but it's probably 5 names now. Tsitsipas, Medvedev, FAA, Zverev, and Sinner. Those are the five guys. I would be shocked if they emerge from this era without a Grand Slam title. That's how good Yannick Sinner has looked of late. Of course, again, there are so many other good matches on the day. Isner doesn't lose tiebreakers, doesn't lose in Miami. He's gone the past 3 years. Champion, finalist, now round of 16 as he knocks off FAA in what was a really fun 7-6, 7-6 match, at least as fun as an Isner match can be. RBA continues to come through in the big moments. 4-6, 6-3, 6-2 win for him over Struff. Francis Tiafoe, three-set matches are what he does. And again, the slower the court, the higher the bounce, the better he is. 1-6, 7-5, 6-3 victory for him over the Deuce, Dusan Lajovic. Taylor Fritz, really nice three-set victory for him over Cam Norrie. Again, that extra half second the conditions in Miami providing him gave him enough time to swing through that backhand. And I think he actually won the backhand to the Norrie lefty forehand exchanges, his serve. I mean, you look at the numbers. In the match, Taylor Fritz makes only 60% of his first serves, but he's 42 of 57, makes 74% of a win, 74% of his first serve points, saves three of the four break point chances he faces. And then Emil Roussevori, who I talked about a little bit on the last mini break podcast, but just continues his form 4-6, 6-1, 7-5 in the Battle of the Nordic States as he knocks off Swede Mikhail Yimmer in what was, again, a really fun match between two youngsters. But that's your weekend action in Miami, and I'm telling you, the round of 16 women's matches, the front half of the round of 32 for the men's side, it delivered the goods on Monday's on Monday in Miami. So you're absolutely going to want to stick around for our part two of this podcast, where, again, I'll talk exclusively about Monday's results. That will have us all caught up for Tuesday night's podcast, which will recap Tuesday's matches, and then from there, we're good to go the rest of the week. Of course, I will remind you, if you have missed any of the action, you need the immediate synopses, you want to hear more about college tennis, you want to hear more about Challenger tennis, you can find out about it all on our website, CrackedRackets.com. Of course, like, rate, subscribe, review to this podcast, the Great Shot Podcast, Cracked Interviews Podcast, and all of our Cracked Rackets shows. You need the more immediate updates, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. We are at Cracked Rackets. You want to message me directly, excuse me. I am at Great Shot Pod. Shout out, as always, to our super producers, Max Liegner and Daniel Westhoff, for the of an editing job they do day in, day out. Shout out as well to our friends at Midwest Sports. Go to MidwestSports.com. Use that promo code CR15. One last shout out. My boy, Old Blue, my old microphone. I call her my boy, but she unfortunately has retired on us. She passed away officially. Of course, again, Old Blue is a microphone that I recorded the first, 1,100 Cracked Rackets podcast with, however many we've done. They were all by Old Blue. And unfortunately, I think she had heard enough of my voice and she was just ready to be done with it. But she was great to me. We'll get a replacement mic. It's already been ordered. It's in the mail. So my peas will stop popping moving forward. But again, it's official. Old Blue, 2017 to 2021. She was fantastic to me, the steadiest thing I had going. Unfortunately, no more podcasts for her. But nevertheless, again, that's really just my way of saying I will have my new microphone in shortly, so the audio quality will be back to where we want it to be. With that in mind, for my wonderful co-host, my wonderful producers, Fligner and Westhoff, our friends at Midwest Sports, and all of us here at both Cracked Rackets and the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, I am your host, Alex Gruskin. You know what we say. That's the break. And we will see you all for part two. Thanks, everyone.